Coming up, Bob Fall reports on comforting the newly bereaved.
I think the loneliness is something that nobody can really prepare you for.
Also, Fred DeSam Lazaro on the sacred cows of India, an estimated 40,000 of them on the streets of Delhi alone.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. In a highly critical new report, a United Nations panel accused the Vatican of systematically putting protection of the Church's reputation above the welfare of children who were sexually abused by priests. The non-binding report by the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child called on the Vatican to immediately remove all known or suspected abusers and turn them over to civil authorities. It also urged accountability for those who covered up the crimes. In response, church officials said the report ignored recent measures to address the abuse crisis. They also rejected the panel's criticism of church positions on other issues, including abortion, birth control, and homosexuality. Joining me with more on this are Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program, and Father Tom Reese, author, expert on the Vatican, and senior analyst at the National Catholic Reporter. Tom, welcome. Welcome back here. What did you make of this UN committee's report?
Well, it was a missed opportunity. I wish they had acknowledged the fact that the church has done something. For example, Pope Benedict put in zero tolerance for any abuse. That means any priest involved in abuse is no longer allowed to be in the priesthood. He threw out 400 priests in the last 2 years of his papacy. I think they should have acknowledged that and then said, okay, make sure you keep enforcing these policies that you have in place.
So, can it be expected that this committee report, it was only a committee report, will have any impact, will cause the Vatican to do anything it otherwise wouldn't do?
Well, it's certainly drawing attention to the problem again. And it does have some good recommendations about, you know, making sure that bishops are accountable, that they fulfill and do the policies that the Vatican has now put in place.
Well, and that's one of the questions. That's been a big issue, is like holding the church leaders, bishops, archbishops accountable, making them pay consequences for their role in it. And that's one thing that hasn't happened. Why hasn't that happened?
Well, that's the real question, and that's the real issue. I think that the Vatican has to go after bishops like Bishop Finn of Kansas City, who's been convicted of not reporting a priest to the civil authorities. Well, I mean, he's just got to go. And you also have the case of the Italian Bishops' Conference, which has decided, well, we're not going to report our bad priests to the police. That's simply unacceptable, and the Vatican has to tell them that.
Pope Francis, obviously very popular, but this is one area where he has drawn some criticism from people who say, yes, he's called sex abusive minors a harm of the church, a shame of the church. He has said he's going to appoint a commission to deal with this, but some people are saying, you know, we've heard apologies, we've heard talk, we've heard studies. When is there going to be actual action? Is this something he's vulnerable on?
Well, I think he's got to hold bishops accountable, that they have to observe the policies that he's established. I think the idea of a commission is good. It brings together experts, and so that all bishops all over the world learn best practices, and they don't make the same mistakes that the American bishops made. That would be very helpful.
What is the situation around the world? Are there places where they're just in denial?
I think so. I think that bishops in the global south and the third world aren't really up to speed on this. And I think it's very important that they learn from the mistakes of the American bishops, of the European bishops, so that they be proactive, that they get to this problem before it explodes on them.
What will satisfy some of the victims' advocates who, you know, on this issue?
Well, the victims' advocates have to speak for themselves, but I think we have to listen to them, first of all. We have to apologize again and again and again. We have to make it clear that we are going to make sure this never happens again. These are the things that victims really want.
But, Tom, is the Vatican ready to start firing people? Well, like the bishop that you referred to in Kansas City?
You know, they haven't been so far. Although in Ireland there have been bishops that have been fired. Cardinal Law, of course, was removed from office. You know, I think we need to see more of that. If we had had 30 or 40 bishops in this country stand up and say, I made a mistake, I take full responsibility, I'm sorry, and I resign, we wouldn't be where we are today.
Father Tom Rees, many thanks. In other news, more than 3,000 leaders from the U.S. and around the world put aside political disagreements for a few moments this week at the 62nd Annual National Prayer Breakfast. President Obama spoke about the importance of religious liberty. Conservatives have criticized his administration's record on religious freedom, but the president said he's committed to defending it around the world.
Promoting religious freedom is a key objective of U.S. foreign policy.
The prayer breakfast usually has a Christian keynoter, but this year's speaker was U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Rajiv Shah, who is Hindu. He urged partnerships between the government and faith-based groups to help the poor.
This morning, I want to share an overarching purpose worthy of this room that has come together to follow the teachings of Jesus. Let us work together to end extreme poverty in our lifetime.
A new report says the abortion rate in the U.S. has fallen to its lowest point since 1973, the year the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision legalized most abortion nationwide. According to the Guttmacher Institute, there were fewer than 17 abortions per 1,000 women in 2011, a 13% decline in recent years. The Institute did not study the reasons for the drop, but said it was likely caused by the effectiveness of new forms of contraception. A controversy this week over publication of the personal notes of the late Pope John Paul II. The new book is I Am Very Much in God's Hands, and the issue is whether it should have been published at all. John Paul left a will saying his notes should be burned, but his longtime former secretary, Cardinal Stanislaw Jivic, said he could not bear to destroy the notes because of what he said was their value in understanding the late Pope's spirituality. We have a special report now from Bob Faw on the bereaved, the grieving and lonely after a loved one's death. For some, the loss challenges their faith. For others, their trust in God is strengthened. In the midst of the pain, how do people cope?
The reason I like staying in this house, it's a symbol. I sort of feel Bill around me.
Mona Hanford lost her husband Bill little more than a year ago. Now the massive camellia tree in her backyard gives her comfort.
The camellia is special because when Bill died last year, he was in his hospital bed in the family room looking out on the garden and the camellia, and it bloomed just as he died. So on the anniversary of his death, it came back. It's sort of like bookends to my year.
It has been over 4 years since Dolores Royston lost her husband, Paul. She will never forget her intense loneliness after he died.
I think the loneliness is something that nobody can really prepare you for. That loneliness, the emptiness, is more than you can describe. Because he was so close to me, and he's my best friend. And that's what you miss.
On Good Friday, Mary Ann Buddy, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, D.C., delivered a sermon about loss and grieving.
How do we bear it? How do we bear the sadness? I think naming it and acknowledging it for what it is, to have people that you can talk to or places you can go, or rituals that can help hold or contain the emotion. We endure these losses time and again and are able to become large enough to hold it and continue on with our lives.
George Bonanno, psychologist and author of the book The Other Side of Sadness, says research shows while 10 to 15% of mourners do suffer depression and might need medical intervention, for the rest, though their loss is always with them, the pain subsides and they can cope because that's how humans have evolved.
Basically, having an acute sadness reaction that comes and goes, but continuing to function, being able to talk to other people and care for other people and concentrate and do whatever job you need to do. I think this comes from our biological wiring. These biological and adaptive systems are extremely effective, and they allow us to cope with things. And we've been doing it since the beginning of time.
Coping, though, was something Daniel Perez could not manage when his daughter Emily, a West Point graduate, was killed while serving in Iraq.
I opened the door, and there was two people in uniform standing there. I just closed the door and said, y'all got the wrong house.
After the initial shock, Perez says he was so consumed tending to his daughter's burial and personal effects and taking care of his wife, Vicky, he could not really take time to mourn until one day.
Went out to the mailbox, and there was a big brown envelope, and it was actually addressed to me. And when I opened it, it was 20 or 30 letters that were written by an elementary class addressed to the father. So then, that's kind of when everything kind of flooded out then, yeah.
For Vicky, grief, immediate and overwhelming, soon undermined her once deep faith.
I had fight with God. I'm like, you know, I did what you told me to do. The child had incredible faith. And she honored us just by the things she did, HIV, AIDS, ministry started at the church, in the choir, tutoring us. And she brought honor to her mother and her father. She brought honor to the whole family. And yet you decide that you allowed this to happen. Not decided you allowed this to happen. And so my faith was shook.
Vicky's response is not unusual, says Kenneth Pargamet, a clinical psychologist at Bowling Green University who has studied grieving and religion.
A trauma can call into question one's entire assumptions about life, whether life is good, whether there is a God who cares, whether there's reason to be hopeful about ourselves, whether our lives have any meaning at all.
For Dolores, a strong faith never wavered. Indeed, she says, it grew stronger, as did her belief in an afterlife.
I believed firmly in an afterlife. I can't imagine living on this earth, going through what you go through, especially with my husband's illness, and not have a better reward somewhere.
Likewise, for Cynthia Woods, still saddened by her mother's death 8 months ago, but now also at peace.
When I saw her after she had passed, there was a glow on her face. She was looking up and off as if she was seeing Jesus and being received. And that just solidified my faith in what we believe in, that our life in Christ here is not in vain, and that we will see her again, but she is at her reward.
Experts agree there is no one way, no right or wrong way to grieve, and the notion that there's a set of stages of grief, denial, anger, depression, bargaining, and acceptance, stages popularized by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, has been challenged, even discredited.
Lots of people have contacted us in the past to point out that it's really been harmful to them because they didn't go through anything remotely like that and there was an expectation that they should, or there must be something wrong because they're not. They've contacted me to say thank you for saying that because I've been fine and everybody keeps telling me there's something wrong.
Of course, for many people, religious traditions, especially rituals, help make grieving endurable.
in these times, then, we need the rituals to help us negotiate this bridge between normal person and mourner, between living and death. So we need rituals to help us facilitate the transition and yet sustain ourselves at the same time. Religious rituals serve the purpose of both continuity and change.
For Mona Hanford, butterflies, representing hope, became a spiritual symbol.
We had these butterflies on the altar. We had hundreds of them.
And some people like Jeannie and Livia Kent create their own symbols. When Charles, Jeannie's husband and Livia's father, died a little more than a year ago, they devised a memorial service 3 months later to celebrate his life.
Preparing for the service was wonderful, and it was a comfort, and it was being creative, and it was accessing my creative energies that helped release my sorrow.
Nothing was imposed upon us. We had this wonderful freedom to just pull from our hearts and what was meaningful for us and create a splendid celebration for this man. There were many rituals that we just made up.
Dear Daniel and Vicki, with the deepest sympathy, you are in my prayers, wishing you peace at this time of sorrow.
These days, Daniel Perez copes with his grief by turning to an imaginary box.
Every now and then I pull the box out. I'll have my moment. I'll shed some tears. And then I close the box back up. So it's something that'll never go away. I just had to learn how to manage it so that it wouldn't overtake me.
However mourning is expressed, the process almost invariably changes attitudes, even lives.
Time and again you'll hear people say, you know, after this happened, I made a course correction because I realized that life is precious and I'm not going to spend my time on things that, this little time that I have left, I'm not going to spend it on the things that are not of ultimate importance to me.
Stripping yourself of all the things that aren't important anymore, it just tells me that there is a God. And he's close to me, and he's helping me.
I'm a different person, a stronger person, and a more compassionate person. I think a more knowing person deep down.
For Daniel Perez, faith, once shaken, was eventually restored.
You wind up accepting what happened, knowing that you had no control over it, and you never understand why God does what he does. So you wind up, I guess, accepting that, okay, this happened. Now, what can we do about that?
Setting up a foundation established in Emily's name to help young women has helped Daniel and his wife to manage their grief and start living again.
I have joy. I got my joy back. It's just a good feeling that she lives on through us. Emily forces us to reach out and help others, and this is what she would have us to do, so therefore, we do it.
So the loss of a loved one can be the closing of one door and the opening of another.
We become less human, I think, if we don't tend to grief in an open-hearted and in generous way. We pick up and face into that abyss and say, yet I will live. Yet I will pass on life and joy. Even if I can't know it myself, I will ensure that others will, and I will find my greater meaning in that.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in Washington, D.C.
We have a Fred DeSam Lazaro story today on the cows of India. Hindu traditions teach that cows are sacred. So Indians share even their most modern cities with many thousands of cows. Hindus protect them in the streets and take care of them until they die.
It may look like an unusual petting zoo, but this is actually a place of reverence to many people in India. This gaushala, or cow shelter, is one of three in India's capital, Delhi. It serves as both barn and sanctuary for 6,000 urban cows. Most are abandoned by their owners to fend for themselves in a mega city of 17 million.
In the Hindu religion, if you take care of cows, your family will prosper and you will have peace.
Your children will have a good spiritual life. God will look after them.
Cows are considered sacred in Hinduism. They're the favorite animal of the deity Lord Krishna and a symbol of wealth, strength, and abundance. The cow's spiritual significance is likely also tied to its very practical role in India since ancient times.
Much of the traditions and rituals have grown out of utility. Although we are not aware of the scientific background of these matters or the correct mythology of certain traditions, but the truth of the matter is every ritual, every rite, every tradition had a strong scientific basis. It was based on moral law, natural law, cosmic law, divine law, moral traditions.
Varma says the veneration of cows quite likely traces back millennia and to its utility on farms for transportation. Cows' milk, butter, and yogurt are important sources of protein in a vegetarian diet by which many Hindus abide. In rural areas, cow dung is used for fuel, and even the urine is collected for use in traditional medicine.
The slaughter of cows is illegal in many parts of India, and even McDonald's, the world's largest hamburger chain, doesn't serve any beef in its India outlets.
But McDonald's is part of India's growing urban landscape. Delhi is a city that's grown farther and farther out into what once was rural land.
When they were on farms, these animals used to work. They pulled carts and plows. Now machines have come in and there's much less use for them. Now people don't have that much space for cows.
An estimated 40,000 of the animals roam freely on the streets of Delhi. They are increasingly seen as a nuisance, clogging traffic and foraging through garbage heaps. And they've become a target for poachers.
We live with people of another religion. Some people of that religion, and I do say some, because there are people in that religion that also honor and serve cows, but some people pick them up from the road.
He was referring to some people among India's Muslims. Muslims do consume beef, but sociologists say there's growing beef consumption among Hindus as well in an increasingly globalized urban India. A single cow can fetch as much as 5,000 rupees, about $90, on the underground market, a big payday here. The cow shelters rely on the faithful to get to the animals first.
People call in to tell us there is a cow on the street or wandered into our home. We provide transportation to bring them in. Some people bring them in themselves and leave them here.
The shelters are supported by public donations, which flowed in abundantly the day we visited, from people who came in to pray and to feed the animals.
We don't ask people to give money. As you saw today, they just come in. When you add together all the money from those who give, all the way from 100,000 rupees to thousands to small amounts, we get about 30 million rupees a year.
That's about $500,000 to allow the animals to live out their natural lives in peace.
Cows have to die, but we don't want them to die of hunger or thirst.
It's a far cry from the grassy rural range that is the more natural habitat, but these animals do have cooling fans and an abundant, if somewhat unusually varied diet, as throngs of devout people preserve or restore the historical reverence for India's urban cow. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in Delhi, India.
On our calendar this week, Valentine's Day, which is named for two Saint Valentines who were martyred in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. The day was not associated with romantic love until the Middle Ages, when Geoffrey Chaucer and others made the connection. Finally, at a car auction in Paris, Pope Francis's Harley-Davidson Dyna Superglide motorbike went on sale. It had been given to Francis last year and bore his signature. The value before the auction was estimated at the euro equivalent of $16,000, but it sold to an unnamed European buyer for $327,000, with the money destined for Caritas Roma, which runs a Catholic soup kitchen and hostel. When one of our producers learned that the selling price for the Pope's Harley was 20 times what had been asked, he wondered if the Pope might consider autographing his car. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more and where you can also listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, gospel singer Yolanda Adams performs "This Too Shall Pass" at the National Prayer Breakfast.
God bless you.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.